Welcome to the Not Old Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelsang, and this is episode number 230. As part of our Art of Living author interview series, our guest today on the Not Old Better Show is author Kathy Izzard. Kathy Izzard, whose new book, The 100 Story Home from HarperCollins, is the story of quitting her job as an award-winning designer, which led to the development of a housing solution for over 100 chronically homeless men and women in Charlotte, North Carolina. Dear Not Old Better audience, this book is remarkable, inspirational, and motivational. We can all do so much when prompted, and doing good has never been more important.
When I was writing this, I was imagining writing it for people in the second half of life who want to do something maybe different than they did the first half. And so your audience is perfect. And I don't think we're ever too old so that we could all get together and learn about it and take some action on it. So I always, when people, I'm talking to book clubs and they say, well, I'm too old to do anything. I say, no, you're not. Let me tell you about this story. So I do hope that this book inspires your audience.
That, of course, is our guest today, Kathy Izzard, whose very personal journey throughout her new book, The 100 Story Home, includes family, coworkers, faith-based organizations, all part of the team of people who influenced, supported, challenged, and surprised her through the process of developing the Street to Home Project. It is a story of revelations, wisdom in unexpected conversations, shocking choreography of timing, and generous and passionate people allowing their lives to blend, mix, and change. It's a story of losing faith, finding it, and listening to the tiny whispers of guidance. The 100 Story Home is among my favorite books, and Kathy reads from one of the chapters for you in just a bit. So please join me in welcoming, via internet phone, Kathy Izzard. Well, Kathy Izzard, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Paul.
It is so great to talk to you. Your book, of course, The 100 Story Home, is wonderful. I'm just going to encourage all of my audience to read that. I know it's just coming out next week. But let's go back. We're going to talk about the book in some detail, but I'd like to also talk a little bit about story. And so, as I like to say, let's start at the start with your kind of growing up in Texas. You really had this idyllic childhood filled with lots of great things, sports and school and church. And you had sisters. You had a mom and dad who father was a very successful attorney. But everything wasn't perfect, as is so often the case. None of us have perfect lives. And your mom had some serious mental health challenges with bipolar that were really, they kind of came up in your formative years. And in your book, The 100 Story Home, you refer to something that just jumped out at me because you're a professional graphic artist and designer. You mentioned that your mom's handwriting was one of the first things that you noticed, one of these early indications as to something not being quite right. And your mom's writing on these index cards, which also comes up a little bit later in the book with regard to Frances Halsey, who I'm looking forward to talking to you about. But that episode, going back to your childhood, really framed some of your perceptions kind of growing up. How so?
Yes, Paul. And I wanted to say, you know, I've done some interviews and I've spoken to a lot of book clubs. You're the first person to notice that connection. And really, I hadn't noticed that until you brought that up. My mom used to have this habit, I think, to order her world when maybe she knew her mind was swirling and headed towards mania. If you know about bipolar disorder, you fluctuate between kind of manic thoughts and depression. And so I started to notice over time that her 3x5 index cards that she would write with a 4-color Bic pen in color and, you know, to keep everything straight, I could always kind of tell when things maybe weren't going well because her handwriting became less legible and less legible as she went towards mania. And I don't know if that had an influence on my later choice as a graphic designer where I then studied fonts, and I can tell you all about typefaces. But certainly that experience, my mom really struggled with what was her diagnosis and finding the right care, the right provider, the right diagnosis, the right prescription for 16 years from the time I was 6 until I was 22. And so I know all of that did lay a foundation for me for empathy for people who were struggling, certainly empathy for people with mental health challenges. And I think certainly that's why I came to have a heart for the homeless, which is what I write a lot about in the 100 Story Home. Because when I met women on the streets of Charlotte who were homeless, I think there was a piece of me that knew that my mom might have ended up in some similar fate or worse fate than she did. She ended up having an incredible life, and she's still with us today, and the grandmothers of my four daughters. But maybe all of that story would have been different if my father didn't have the resources to care for her, or if they hadn't stayed together in their marriage, or as many people who suffer from mental health challenges take their own lives. So I think my story was very fortunate in the type of parents I had, the type of household, but all of that gave me a heart for the work that I would do later.
Yeah, so I think that's a nice way of putting it, a heart. And certainly in my mind, as I was reading it, it gave you this courage and strength. And in chapter 3, and you use quotes throughout the book, which I just thought was marvelous. But at the top of chapter 3, you use a quote from Friedrich Buechner, I think is how it's pronounced. But you say,
yes,
and I think it's just an excellent quote. It really gives great evidence to this notion of your courage. Friedrich Buechner says, here's the world, beautiful and terrible things will happen. Don't be afraid. And I thought that was an important quote in all of this. But when did that kind of notion first influence you, of your strength and your ability to have a heart and then drive you further?
Well, first of all, I love Buechner. I think he probably has a quote for every situation in life. But I think it really took me decades to understand what he was talking about. I think for a really long time, I thought that the way to get through life was to really hold on to everything tight, or to fool myself into believing that I could control everything. And really, it wasn't until I started letting go and starting having a little more faith in something bigger than myself that I got a different perspective. I think Richard Rohr has another great comment on all of this, and he has a book called Falling Upward that talks a lot about how when life brings you to your knees, that we truly grow and we truly imagine what we're capable of. So I think that's what I wrote about in the 100 Story Home as well, about a lot of circumstances that got me to the point where I really, things were so hard and I was trying to control it all myself and do it all myself. And it wasn't really until I let go that things started working differently. And I think that really influenced my faith and the ability to believe in something bigger than myself.
Mm-hmm. Which is a very important theme throughout the book. And we'll jump ahead a little bit, certainly to your successful life in Charlotte, North Carolina, as a graphic designer, a very highly regarded professional graphic designer with four daughters. You felt this stirring, you felt this kind of this change about doing something bigger with your life. And throughout the book, you say your father talks and your grandfather talks about doing good. That was really how you were brought up as a child.
I was. I was raised by family who really felt service was an important part of life and of living. And so I was raised to do good. My father, while he thought marriage and family were really important, he never asked me about getting married or having kids. He wanted to have conversations about what I was going to do to change the world or how I was going to leave the world a better place. And he used to tell me, you know, Kathy, you can do anything, you know, really anything. And while I know he meant for that to be empowering, I think it felt a little paralyzing at the same time because he died when he was only 64 and I was in my 40s. And I really had regret that I hadn't done something big to kind of live up to those dreams. While the graphic design was a, you know, great career, I was making money, it didn't seem to live up to his notion of leaving the world a better place. And that's a lot of reason why I ended up writing this book and writing it down, because I wanted to give readers courage and faith in their dreams. Mm-hmm. I was about 44 when some of this started, and I never imagined that I could build a building or write a book, and all of that happened. So I really believe that now that we're never too old or too young to be who we're meant to be. And as long as you're willing to wake up every day and try something, put one step forward on a new path, I think anything is possible.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is a real message of courage and faith. And again, I just would encourage all my audience to pay attention to this book, not just read it, but absorb it, because I think it's fascinating to read about this transition that you go through, this kind of the state of enlightenment, because the challenges of your mom we talked about, which definitely got much better, and good to hear that your mom is now a happy grandmother to your children. But your daughters also had some health scares. And at one point you phoned your dad and he suggested prayer. And you said, paraphrasing, you said, I wish I thought it would help. I wish I thought it could help. And so there was a real kind of enlightenment that took place. With your daughter's medical scares, was that kind of the beginning of some of that, or did it start someplace else, your kind of transition to this this notion of something bigger and this idea of faith?
I think it was probably always with me, Paul. Mm-hmm. I was raised by a long line of Presbyterian ministers and missionaries, and then my father was an attorney because he felt that was a life of service. My grandfather was a doctor because he felt that was a life of service. And while I was always, you know, taken with them to the Presbyterian Church and had organized religion, I think I ran away from it in my 20s and 30s because I thought it was nice that they believed that, but I felt maybe that religion just didn't apply to me or I couldn't make my sense of it. And certainly with my mother's struggles and my family praying so hard for her health, in some ways I didn't feel the prayers were answered. So I think for a long time I really ran the other way. And maybe the deepest part of my change began not only before I started doing the work at the Urban Ministry Center, mm-hmm. but watching my father deal with his leukemia when he was dying. He was diagnosed, and in only 9 months, he was gone. And so he, even in that, even in his cancer battle and his struggles, he maintained this really deep faith. And I think that started to really rock my foundation a little bit and make me wonder, well, was there something in it for me, and maybe I should give it another look?
I think my audience will really relate to this idea of service and doing good. And that began over this kind of this period of time, but resulted in some work that you began doing as a volunteer for the Urban Ministry Center, which you just mentioned. So tell us a little bit about the Urban Ministry Center, what that is, where it is, and maybe where it led you.
So the Urban Ministry Center is the interfaith agency in Charlotte that serves the homeless, people experiencing homelessness on the streets. And they have a soup kitchen. I think there's probably a lot of your listeners live in cities that have soup kitchens mm-hmm. or service provider for homeless. Mm-hmm. And I ended up down there serving soup because I wanted to introduce my daughters to a life of service. And while I was having this graphic design career, my husband was in the finance world. I thought this was something we could do to teach them to do good. So we started going down there one Sunday a month. And the first Sunday we went down there, I can tell you it was shocking. I had no idea that we even had as many people experiencing homelessness as we found down there. When we first got there, the parking lot was filled with hundreds of people that I don't normally see in Charlotte. So that was my first eye opening. And then just going in, and we would make sandwiches, we would serve maybe 600 people on any given day. And so all of that was really eye opening in itself. But then to watch my daughters, how much they loved helping and how much more courageous they were than I was. I would kind of stand behind the counter and serve soup with a smile, but my girls were fearless and they would run out from behind the counter and, you know, give Kool-Aid and drinks to people and sit down and talk and just naturally hug and try to be helpful. And I think I stayed behind the counter really a little fearful of the people we were serving. I think I had some preconceptions of what people who were homeless were, and I think maybe I knew their lives were tragic and messy, and I would feel responsible if I got to know somebody. And so I really stayed safely behind the counter for a very long time, a little afraid of the people, a little afraid of their stories. But most of all, I really didn't think I could do anything. I didn't think I could do anything beyond what I was already doing, and I really wasn't sure that I wanted to, honestly.
Well, in this process, this kind of this change, another step along the way was your reaching out in a very, I love this because sometimes I have to do some cold calling in my line of work.
That's the worst.
And you did this brilliantly, I thought. In your book, you talk about these authors, Denver Bohr and Ron Hall, which you reach out to and you contact them. They're famous in their own right. So that was kind of a leap of faith, if you will. But in doing, and maybe you could tell us a little bit about that outreach, because Denver Moore had impact on Ron Hall and his wife Debbie, of course, and Ron and Debbie had had an impact and influence on Denver Moore. And so it all really is this beautiful circle, I thought. But it started with you kind of making this call, and that really started the process of some of the rest of the story, which we'll get to.
Yeah, so I read the book, same kind of different as me, which mm-hmm. is about Ron Hall and Denver Moore meeting in a soup kitchen in Fort Worth in Dallas, Texas. And the story haunted me because they had done, Ron and his wife Debbie had done what I had been too afraid to do, which was actually meet someone, which was to actually befriend someone in homelessness. And they befriended Denver Moore, and I think they thought they might be kind of reaching down and pulling Denver up, and Denver ended up saving them right back. Mm-hmm. And they became more than friends, they became family. And I got what I talk about in my book, my first whisper. I just got this tiny voice telling me that I should reach out to these guys and that I should bring them to Charlotte to speak. And it was crazy. I don't know why, but I just could not stop this thought. So one day I did. I sent Ron an email and I just said, I don't know if you guys speak, but if you do, would you come speak for the Urban Ministry Center? And I thought maybe we could raise some money for them. And crazy, he emailed me right back 20 minutes later. So I couldn't get out of it. I did it before I had time to go, oh, that was nuts. Why did I do that? He answered me and they ended up coming, and I ended up being in charge of a fundraiser that was 1,000 people. Here I am, a mother, a graphic designer. I am not a special events planner, and I am the chair of a 1,000-person event to raise money for the homeless in Charlotte. And I thought, what in the world had I been doing? And I ended up taking Denver as a result of that down to the Urban Ministry Center. Mm-hmm. I thought he was going to tell us that we were doing such a great job. And instead, as I was touring him through, he very painfully pointed out to me what I had never been able to see. And that was that we were doing all this good in the day, but we were locking them out to the bad at night. Mm-hmm. And that the Urban Ministry Center, while these has these amazing services in the day, we are not a shelter. We had not a single bed. And Denver pointed that out to me in a way that really just opened my eyes, and I just couldn't see it differently ever again. But most importantly, Denver looked at me, and once he realized I was having this aha moment, he looked at me and said, so what are you going to do about it? Mm-hmm. And that was the moment that I just had to decide, well, now that I see, how will I live? What will I do with that information? And it ended up I couldn't sleep very well at night anymore. I started feeling a lot like the people who were outside, not sleeping very well. And so I ended up quitting my job and going to work for the Urban Ministry Center to try and figure out how would we do that? How would we do better than just services in the day? How would we really give people what they needed, which was a home and a bed and a safe place?
I love that story. I think that's one of the most powerful elements in the book. Of course, I relate to it because of the cold calling element, but it also produced an aha moment, and Denver Moore then surfaces later in the book. But as we kind of go through the book and some of this process, the aha moment really started to teach you a little bit about homelessness, and then you began almost teaching yourself. You really had to take a crash course on this subject. So tell us a little bit about what you learned there immediately about homelessness and this condition, this crisis.
Yeah, there was, I definitely went from, you know, my first day of work where I went, oh my gosh, this is fantastic. I'm going to do something. I have this new course in life. And then realizing, oh my gosh, I have no idea what I'm talking about. And so I needed to learn about homelessness. I needed to learn about homeless service providers, about development, about real estate. There was so much that I had to learn. And luckily, no one had this job in Charlotte. I went to work for an agency that was doing a lot. But in terms of actually housing, no one was doing that. So lucky for me, I was just willing to wake up every day and try. But I think the most important thing I learned is that homeless is really an adjective. It doesn't describe somebody's character. It describes a certain situation that they're in. And I think a lot of people say homeless people, meaning that they're bad people or lazy people, or they deserve this life somehow that they've gotten. And I really learned that's 100% the opposite. I found people who'd gone to college and people with incredible character and an incredible faith who are surviving a really unimaginable circumstance. So I really try to say now, I don't say homeless people. I try to say people experiencing homelessness. Mm-hmm. Because the fact is, I never met someone who said, oh gosh, you know, when I grew up, I really wanted to be homeless. And here I am, I've achieved my dream. You know, what you meet people who are experiencing homelessness, they had blindsiding health conditions or lost their job in unimaginable ways or had tragic circumstances with death and loss. And here they were at the lowest point. So I think the most thing I learned about homelessness is no one expects to be there and no one wants to stay there.
The line that, again, there are so many, but one that jumped out at me that you use is that homeless people, after they begin to have a home, after they become housed, they're people. And I just thought that was an eye-opener for me, and I learned a great deal myself. I think one of the other things that I learned, and one of the challenges as we begin to understand what homelessness means, is to understand that all the costs involved in not solving the homeless crisis are significant, all of those costs. And in the book, this is chapter 11 I'm referring to now, titled Million Dollar Larry, there's this really quantifiable economic argument that you make that to house the homeless is far better for society in so many ways, but the economic reality is such that we need to look at it from that perspective because it's just so much more expensive to have somebody out on the street and not in a home.
Yeah, that was a real revelation as I went through my education and the self-education, is that I came to this work through a heart for it and being challenged by Denver and realizing that, you know, you couldn't allow people to die on the streets. That just, you know, I couldn't sleep at night with that. But I found out there really was an economic argument. So there's a head and a heart argument to housing the chronically homeless. And when you're talking about people who are chronically homeless, they've been on the streets at least a year or three times in 4 years, you really are talking about people who have a disability, whether it's mental, physical, intellectual. There's a reason that they cannot get out of their circumstance. And that usually costs the cities money, which you don't even realize, because those people are cycling in and out of your jails. They're cycling in and out of your ER rooms. It's a survival technique sometimes to get arrested on a misdemeanor crime like public urination. If you know there's a snowstorm coming, some people would really choose to be in jail where they call it three hots and a cot rather than stay outside and freeze to death. And so all of these hidden costs added up, and we found out that it, when we did some math and talked to some other people who were doing work in different cities, it cost about $37,000 per year to allow someone who's chronically homeless to stay on the streets. Yet a program that we were looking to try was going to cost us about $13,000 per year to house someone. And the really most remarkable thing is, for $37,000 a year, cities were going to spend that the next year and the next year and the next year until that person died on the streets. But for $13,000, you were not only going to save someone's life, you were going to change their life, and you could have productive outcomes as a result.
Really insightful information, just some great metrics, really, I think.
It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. We are with, of course, Kathy Izzard, the author of the new book, just going to be out next week, entitled The 100 Story Home. It's a wonderful book. I would encourage all of you to check this book out. And Kathy Izzard, I want to jump ahead a little bit more, and I want to talk about your work on this big project that you took on. The first part of it, though, was to move 4 individuals directly from street to home. What was that like? And maybe talk about those first 4. That was the pilot program behind a lot of the work that's to come.
Right. So once I started the job and reading, and we realized that this work was being done in other cities, and they were using the housing first philosophy. And housing first kind of turned the whole homeless service agency idea on its head, because traditionally homeless service agencies were working with people with the idea, well, that as soon as you got clean and sober, or as soon as you got a job, or as soon as you got some income, then they would be able to help you find housing. And Housing First said just the opposite. Housing First starts with the idea that just by the fact that someone's a human being, then they deserve housing. And the idea that if you move someone in and give them not only the dignity of being housed, but also some good sleep at night, frankly, then really change is possible. And so that's what we wanted to do, is to start with a pilot group, hope that this worked, hope that we got the same results in other cities, and then maybe build our own building and have our own complete program like they did in other cities. So we started off wanting to find some apartments. It took us a really long time to find any landlord who was working with us. We had one donor who was funding the pilot program. So we weren't looking for free apartments, but once you got to the conversation with the landlord and you said, okay, well, we're going to be moving in some people directly from street to home, the conversation kind of stopped. And so we did finally find one landlord with four apartments who was willing to work with us, really because he had a deep faith and he thought it was something that he was called to help with. And so our first weekend was May 17th, 2008, and we were going to be moving the first people in directly from street to home. There was a gentleman who'd been living in a barn for about 7 years. There's another man who'd been living in our shelters for almost a decade. There was someone who had completed a drug treatment program for 28 days, but was going to be released back onto the streets because he had nowhere to live. And then there was this woman who'd been living under cars for most of the last 3 years because she was too scared to stay in our shelters. So those were our first four. We called our program Homeless to Homes, and we moved them in. And I think you wanted me to read a little bit from my book about that first day.
I would love it if you would. I think our audience would love to hear just that section, if you can do that for us.
Yeah, sure. I had drafted Charlie, my husband, and my daughters, along with 20 volunteers, to serve as the moving crew. The moving truck, loaded with donated furniture items, and each of the new tenants were going to meet us at the apartments. That morning, I was frantically throwing things in my car I thought we'd need. Trash bags, paper towels, brooms. Did we need shelf lining paper? Would they care? Lauren watched me shaking her head. It's going to be fine, Mom, really. I pulled out of the driveway. Charlie followed in another car loaded with more boxes, and Kaylee, Emma, and Maddie behind us. I was going over a checklist in my head when Lauren reached into the glove compartment and pulled out a CD. She put it in the player and searched for the right song. When I recognized the first few bars, I turned to look at her, my mouth open in astonishment. She smiled at me and turned it up. Perfect, right? She said. The lyrics to I'm Amazing, a Keb Mo song, started playing, and Lauren and I sang along loudly. I had used this song to make a slideshow for our fundraiser with Denver and Ron. As the 1,000 guests had entered the ballroom, it had played as background to photos of the Urban Ministry Center and all the amazing things that happened there. The soccer, the art, the gardening, all the things that I thought were enough, more than enough. Now today there would be more. Four people would no longer be homeless. I teared up as Lauren and I belted out together with Keb Mo how grateful we were for the simple things that we don't ever stop to think about. I was so grateful for this new path that had unstuck me from my safe world. I had no idea what was ahead, but I knew that today felt amazing. No one could stop smiling all day, least of all me. As volunteers helped Raymond, Samuel, Ruth, and Jay move in, it was eye-opening how few possessions each owned and how they carried these items to their new homes. No suitcases or boxes, just green plastic garbage bags holding all they had in the world. Salvaged clothes and shoes, a few toiletries, maybe a wrinkled 4x6 photo. Each new tenant was over 40 years old, yet from four decades of living, these few plastic bags were the only evidence of that life. Ruth, Raymond, Samuel, and Jay moved through their new homes with disbelief. Mark's apartments were simple, two-bedroom apartments with front doors opening onto a grass lawn. The new tenants kept coming in and out of their new front doors in astonishment. Is this my own garden? Raymond asked. How about that? I'm going to plant me some tomatoes. Y'all come see my house, Ruth invited each volunteer. I can't believe I will be able to watch movies and not have to fight with all the other guys in the shelter, Samuel shook his head in wonder. At bedtime, I was exhausted, but I couldn't sleep. At first, the day's happy images rolled in my head like a Disney movie, with the Keb Mo soundtrack playing in the background. Raymond marveling at his own bathtub, Samuel opening and closing his refrigerator door, Ruth testing the softness of her couch. It had really been a remarkable day. Panic woke me at 2 a.m. I was used to waking up at night worried about my teenage daughters. Were they home? Did they make curfew? But this night I was wide awake, worried about my new family. I now had four other new teenagers in my life. What if Raymond, unfamiliar with his new stove, had started a fire in Marcus' apartment? What if newly sober Jay was having a party in his apartment? How would I explain that to our donors, the Moores? Monday morning, I arrived at the Urban Ministry Center full of dread, expecting Joanne, our case manager, to fill me in on some horrible happening. But I couldn't find her. Ruth, however, was in her usual place monitoring the shower counter. She waved at me. Ruth never waved at me. She was also smiling and wide awake and neatly dressed in a clean shirt with a necklace. A necklace? I had never seen Ruth wear a fashion accessory. Cautiously, I walked over to talk to her. Hey, Ruth. She gave me a huge, unprompted, first-time-ever hug. Kathy! How were your first two nights? I asked her. Did you see how it rained yesterday? She said. I nodded, and I wasn't sure why that mattered. It rained yesterday, and I didn't get wet, Ruth marveled. I found out there were no parties that weekend, no incidents. Raymond confided he spent the whole weekend filling his bathtub with Mr. Bubbles, soaking until the hot water cooled, then doing it all over again. Looking at the photos from that move-in day, I framed one to keep on my desk. In it, all the move-in volunteers surround Ruth, and her smile is electric. It was a constant reminder that whenever it rains, at least now, Ruth doesn't get wet. And Raymond gets wet by choice in his own bathtub. I made a silent vow to myself that in 2 years, by 2010, there would be a picture on my desk of dozens more smiling, dry Ruths and freshly showered Raymonds with places to call home.
Thank you. That is beautiful. I think that's a powerful section, Kathy Izzard. I know you're very busy today, and so I just have a couple final questions. One, really kind of my penultimate question here has to do with one of the other people that you moved, and that's Cowboy Bill and his mother, Frances Halsey. It's just an amazing story about this gentleman, Bill, who is also a graphic designer. He built this very interesting structure, which took him underground in many ways. I think that structure showed you an artistic design side that impressed you. But I think what impressed me is the story of Frances Halsey and the notes and how all of that came full circle for you. So if you would, maybe please tell us that story.
Yeah, so Bill Halsey was someone that we were serving in the Urban Ministry Center. We've been serving him for almost a decade, and he's this really gentle cowboy. He always wore this brown leather cowboy hat and bright blue eyes, and he had this really unusual homeless living arrangement. He had dug an 8 by 8 foot hole in the ground, and that's where he lived at night. And to kind of fast forward through the book, we ended up going from the pilot program to building our own building. And the book does tell all of the miraculous stories of how we did that. And Bill was one of the first people that moved into that building that we named Moore Place in honor of Denver Moore and also John and Pat Moore, who funded our pilot program. I don't think it was a coincidence that they were all three shared the last name, yet don't know each other at all. Mm-hmm. So that building was standing at this amazing miracle, and Bill moved in. And during the time that we'd been raising the money for that building, which was almost $10 million, which we raised in a recession, which is crazy on itself, mm-hmm. the $10 million was raised in unbelievable ways. The city of Charlotte got behind that like you can't imagine. We had children who would have lemonade stands and send us $105. We had corporate gifts. We had churches that banded together and all took up offerings and gave money. But one of my favorite stories was one day when I was at the Urban Ministry Center, I got a card in the mail And it was just like a Hallmark card, a pink envelope. And when I opened it up, a couple of dollars fell out, like $8. And there was no name, and I had no idea who it was from. It just said, "May God bless and multiply this small amount." And that was it. And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that someone had sent their last dollars to help with this campaign for More Place. And 2 weeks later, I got another one. It was a different card and a different amount, but the same thing, no name. And just a little note, "May God bless and multiply this small amount." And they kept coming, Paul. Every 2 or 3 weeks, they would come to the Urban Ministry Center offices. We had no idea who had sent them. When we built the building, we put the name of every single person on the wall on the plaque. We have hundreds of names on the wall, except for this one. We had no idea who'd been sending us this money. But when we built More Place, the cards moved from the Urban Ministry Center offices, and they started coming to the More Place offices. And we still didn't know who our mailbox angel was. Until one day, the director of More Place called me and said, "Kathy, I think I know who's sending these." Because for once, our mailbox angel had written her name in the upper left-hand corner. And her name was Frances Halsey. And what we found out is that Frances was Bill's mom. And all this time, when he was living in a hole in the ground, she knew that he was homeless in Charlotte, but she didn't know how to find him. She knew that he got services at the Urban Ministry Center. And she read about More Place in the paper. And she thought, "Well, I don't know if this is going to help my son, but I know it's going to help somebody's son." And so for years, she sent us her $5 and her cards and her prayers and hoping that it would matter. And it did, because her son, Bill Halsey, moved in with us. They were reunited. And that's the way we found our mailbox angel, which was just a miracle in itself, kind of like all the miracles of More Place. And the reason I had to write the 100-story home, because you can't make that stuff up. And you can't make up all the miracles that happened that made it all come true. But More Place is standing today. It houses over 130. And since 2012, we've housed more than 500 chronically homeless people in Charlotte.
It's such a touching story. And I think what's equally touching about this, Kathy Izzard, is your love for these people. And you went so far as to visit Frances Halsey, met her in person, which also shows your compassion and really, I think, a hallmark of the book. And that is that as we reach out and get to know each other as humans, there's really no other course of action than to help. And you really, I thought, did that so nicely with this Frances Halsey story about Bill Halsey. And yes, I thought the coincidences were so much more than just a coincidence. So I just have a final question for you, two-part perhaps. How's your faith now? And what advice do you give to those of us who are, you know, as you referred to earlier in our conversation, kind of hear this tiny whisper? Should we be willing to listen?
Oh, I would say to anyone listening, absolutely. My faith went from a place that I think a lot of us are in, where I feel like religion is a little polarized right now. There's maybe people who believe in nothing, and then there's people really certain on the other end, and maybe are can't understand how people aren't as certain as they are on the other end. And sometimes it feels like there's not much in between. And I think that's why I just went to the other side of, well, I can't be certain, and I'm not as religious or as evangelical as some people. And so that made me go to nothing. This whole experience made me find that there's so much more in between. And I can't help but believe that there's something bigger than us, something bringing us together, and something that really calls us all to do good in the world. I don't believe I was special or chosen in 2007 when I started hearing those whispers. I think I used to think that a call was only for people to enter the ministry. My sister is a minister, and I wrote about her in the book. But I really believe now, after the last 10 years, that we're all called, to abundant and purposeful living. And I really do believe that there's something that's calling to each one of us, whether it's something as small as what Francis was doing, which was writing cards and notes of encouragement, or whether it's as big as building a building. I don't think you have to quit your job, but I do think there's a little voice that whispers to each one of us. And sometimes, well, most often, I think it's crazy and it feels inconvenient and you don't want to listen to it. But I really do believe that those whispers are what's pointing each of us to what we're meant to do. And they're pointing each of us to our true north. And I started with that first whisper of listening to Bring Ron in Denver, which led to the event, which led to working for the Urban Ministry Center, which led to the pilot program, then to building a building, then to writing a book about it, working on another mental health initiative. And now I'm reading and I'm speaking and talking about it, and none of that I planned. If you had asked me 10 years ago, would you have written a book and would you have be speaking and talking about it and building buildings and knowing about homelessness or mental health, I would have told you you were absolutely crazy. But all of that started when I just started listening to the small voices and whispers that were pointing me in a different direction than my life was taking. And I'm really grateful for it.
We're grateful, too, for the book. Kathy Izzard's joined us today. She's the author of the new book, The 100-Story Home. I, again, encourage you, audience, my dear audience, to read this book. It is wonderful. It's a blueprint for life, but it's also a blueprint for how to do good. There's so much more to the story, as Kathy mentions, and I will tell you, too, that these ideas of fundraising and capital campaigns and endowment funds, they're all in this book, and you can learn so much, but importantly, we can learn about each other and this crisis of homelessness. And so, Kathy Izzard, thanks so much. I could talk to you for many, many more hours. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk again. I would look forward to it, but thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kathy. My thanks as well to the HarperCollins team for all they do to support our interviews. My thanks to our guest today, and please check out our website at notold-better.com for more information and conversation. And thanks to all of you, my wonderful audience, for your charming, encouraging, and advice-driven emails with show and topic suggestions. Please keep them coming at info@notold-better.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at notoldbetter. And you can find us on Facebook as well. We are Not Old Better there on Facebook. Podcasts of the Not Old Better Show are available on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. Also on Amazon's Alexa. How are you today, Alexa?
I'm doing great.
Alexa, play the Not Old Better podcast.
Getting the latest episode of the Not Old Better Show. Here it is from TuneIn.
You can always find us online at notold-better.com, where you can find all of our archives. You can share a link, you can get in touch, and I look forward to hearing from you. I'm Paul Vogelzang, and please, everyone, let's talk about better, the Not Old Better Show. Thanks, everybody.